Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. This week on Ring of Fire Radio, a new contributor to the Ring of Fire podcast. We will welcome political analyst and progressive superstar Emma Vigeland to the show. And of course, we'll run down the biggest stories of the week with Heather Digby Parton. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the program. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. So, folks, we have an announcement here at Ring of Fire Radio. We are welcoming a new person to join us on the Ring of Fire team. I guess it's been just me for a while. And, of course, Scott Milliken, our ace producer. I would like to welcome Emma Vigeland. Emma, welcome to Ring of Fire Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on, Sam, and entrusting me with all of these wonderful interviews and the espousing of knowledge and me learning and sharing my learning with the audience. I'm very pumped.
Well, that's what it's all about here. We're going to be doing, going forward, we're going to be doing a couple more interviews a week, maybe at least one more interview a week, at least that you'll be doing. So we'll be able to do a couple. And eventually we're going to go back to our paywall, full paywall, situation where part of the show will be held back for members. In the meantime, people have been supporting the program. You know, we've been trying to keep it open during COVID, so what we try and do down here, at Ring of Fire, as opposed to, what we do on the Majority Report, shorter interviews, although sometimes they tend to run long, but more reported pieces. So this will give us an opportunity to bring attention to more stories. ProPublica has been doing a lot of great pieces lately, particularly on how Trump is trying to burrow people into the civil service. You know, one of the projects, Emma, and we've talked about this before too, that the Republicans had in this administration was, as Steve Bannon said very early on in the administration, to deconstruct the administrative state. And they have done
and ungoverning and
really, to further the logic of that, it's really, we're talking about lawlessness.
Yep.
And it is an attempt by the Republicans. And this, again, too often this is attributed to Donald Trump as opposed to the Republicans. It is an attempt to allow corporations an unfettered ability to essentially abuse the commons, and including the commons, not just sort of like I include in that the citizenry, for their own profit. And this program got its start by Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. And Mike Papantonio is one of the top tort lawyers in the country. And twice a year, when it's not a pandemic, I go to Las Vegas for a tort conference and have really interesting interviews and disturbing ones with attorneys who, it's a wide range of people, but attorneys who will spend months, often years, digging into corporate malfeasance. And it is an interesting interplay between the sort of statutory obligations these companies have and how the existence of these laws become leverage points for these attorneys. And, they are sort of a second order regulatory scheme. When the first regulatory scheme has either been skirted or has been dismantled, these tort lawyers leverage the expectations that maybe consumers have of these companies, or that citizenry has of these companies, and makes them pay a huge price so that they change their business practices. And so that's basically the lineage of this show. And so we tend to do, a lot of interviews about the regulatory schemes and about what's happening with the environment and companies and corporate malfeasance. And to a certain extent, that is, you know, the Republican Party has been an extension of that.
Well, certainly. Yeah. I mean, I think my first thought in discussing this, and we talked about this off air too, is just that it's not a coincidence that Republicans aid and abet this kind of behavior, because it's embedded in both their philosophy and in the way that they're funded. So that's a lot of what I'd like to talk about on the show. And I think that dovetails nicely with what you're discussing.
Well, you know, one of the things I have spent over the past 15 or so years, I mean, I grew up in a decent sized city in Massachusetts, and as a kid in high school had some experience actually in local government, but I've spent a decent amount of time over the past 15 years living in a pretty rural area. And it has been fascinating watching the perspective of some people in the community. They perceive political positions, right? Like being the mayor or sitting on a county supervisor board or something like that as an extension of their businesses. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating and also depressing and upsetting. But like, I own a local food supply. I'm going to get on this town board, and I'm going to make sure that my buddy who owns the tractor supply place, he gets a low cost, you know, loan from the county. And then he sends me some work over here. I mean, it's all perceived that way, which is one of the things that, you know, and I have arguments with libertarians about how they want to shrink the size of government. It's like, well, some of the most corrupt government we have are on a local level.
Are the smallest of governments.
It's easier to buy,
right,
essentially. And the Republican Party, and, you know, this is not to say the Democratic Party doesn't have its own faults. They have plenty of them. But the Republican Party is a party constructed largely to leverage government to its ends. And, you know, we talk about neoliberal philosophy. The beginnings of neoliberalism, the genuine neoliberalism as developed in Mount Pelerin in the following World War II, and as practiced by, you know, back in the day, like Hayek and then ultimately Milton Friedman and et cetera, et cetera. Their perception is that government should be set up to do stuff, but it should be specifically to help powerful corporations as existing. You know, it's not laissez-faire. They want there to be, they don't want the government to be laissez-faire. They just want it to function
in a symbiotic way with multinational corporations.
Yes. And in a way that also, like, both, and multinational is correct too, because if you look at some of the neoliberal project from an international level, it is to make sure that there is not too much sovereignty amongst countries so that they don't have the ability to curb existing industry.
I mean, well, certainly. I mean, many multinational corporations have much more power and influence than a majority of countries in the world.
Certainly. And, but, you know, when you look at something like the TPP and to a certain extent, NAFTA as well, they have these investor state dispute boards, which essentially work out a sort of separate system of adjudicating the sovereign actions of a government. So in other words, they're in this trade deal, and if the government or the people or wherever you want to, you know, sort of where you want to stick your flag in that sort of process, decide like, we want these environmental regulations, or we realize now that a certain chemical or a certain product is detrimental to the health of the society. If you're a multinational corporation who is counting on certain product profits from the sale of that, you can now, you know, or under one of these investor, you know, this is under the TPP and, like I said, to a certain extent under the NAFTA and the updated version of NAFTA, you can sue the federal government, you can sue the U.S. federal government, you can sue a municipality, a state.
Give for them equal standing.
For right. Inhibiting your profits. And the suit is not in U.S. courts. Right. It's in a
tribunal.
A tribunal made up of industry lawyers. But the idea there, that's a classic neoliberal idea of where you are basically inhibiting the sovereignty of this country, because it's going to, they're going to have to pay money if they decide that, hey, wait a second, this chemical that we have now realized is causing cancer in our people, we're going to have to say, you can't sell that anymore. Well, okay, here's the money. Then we got to pay over money. But so that is the lineage. That's a very long-winded way of saying that's the lineage of the show.
Well, it does bring us back to some of the core philosophies and underpinnings that we hope to discuss, right? So that's the kind of orbit that I hope to be operating in, and speaking to reporters and investigators who have a good sense of these structures and have done investigative work on specific cases. So I look forward to that. And I hope to bring something to the show, and, you know, be patient with me as I feel my way through it.
There you go, audience. Well, I have
speaking directly to you.
Speaking on behalf of the audience, I think they're happy to have you, and they expect you to hit the ground running. They're not worried about your you're not going to need too much patience from them. But let's I'm going to be talking to Digby following this about doing the weekend wrap. But again, it's like one of those. I look back on the past 4 years of just like every single time Heather Parton and I start a conversation, it's like, whoa, we didn't think it could get crazier than the week before.
Right.
And we are still sort of living in that world. The stakes feel, I mean, it's interesting. You know, this week you're watching, it's almost like you're watching, you ever seen those clips of like the old rockets they would send up into, you know, to the moon or to into space, where it's like just first the some of the engines fly off, right, and then the sort of the next stage flies off, and then it's just like a little capsule,
tiny little thing.
That's what feels like was happening with Trump right now.
Oh my God, yeah,
right. Like it's
except
like
he's crashing.
Well, yes, except for it's going the opposite direction. But this week, Bill Barr said publicly, no evidence of fraud that would change the election outcome. So he has basically abandoned ship. You had,
and as I said on the show, you have to be completely devoid of evidence to get Bill Barr, who is a total authoritarian lackey, to admit that.
If Bill Barr thought there was even a shred of ability to maintain this farce, he would do it. I mean, without a doubt. In fact, you know, one of the things that I really worry about, and I don't know really what you do about this, is that like, we've created a certain muscle memory throughout our whole system now, right? Which is like not to react to this type of stuff, but there's going to be another time where this happens. And there's no doubt in my mind, if it was even like remotely closer of a call, mm-hmm, that they would just be going ahead with the plan as planned.
Oh, certainly. If it came down to one state, if it came down to two states, three states.
And I mean, if there was any toehold, I mean, let's remember now, they went through, you know, it's easy to forget this, but like 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was some real established major law firms that were representing them in these cases. And they, like that metaphor, they dropped and they took off.
Right.
And they were, you know, left with, you know, a bad dye job. And, you know, Sidney Powell
was involuntarily ejected.
She was involuntarily rejected. But the point is that it wouldn't have taken much for those firms to stay in on this. And that buys them a certain amount of credibility. And this could have gone the other way very easily, I think, at any point. I think now we're out of the woods and into the next woods, which is like deficit reduction,
austerity and attempts.
Austerity, yeah. And obstruction by the Republicans.
The Georgia races.
Well, it's going to be fascinating. I think part of the reason why Barr did this week, because he still has a little bit of time, right? I mean, like, you know, the electors aren't being elected for another week or two. I take Barr doing this And we also have to remember, like, there's a lineage here, right? Because Barr attempted to have that investigation. Mm-hmm. He wanted the investigators and the investigators, and they balked against it. Like, there's a lot of things cut against Barr's attempt here to hold on to power. But I think the reason why he's announcing this now, right, at the beginning of the week, really, I mean, like, December 11th, December 14th, I think are the dates that stick in my mind. I don't know off the top of my head where electors are being, you know, actually becoming official.
11th is the government shutdown. So it might
11th, be 14th. Okay. Yeah, I think he's doing it now because they're afraid of Georgia. I think, you know, we were talking about this week on the Majority Report a couple of times. I think he is getting the word from other Republicans that, hey, we could lose the Senate because Donald Trump is still out there. He's attacking Brian Kemp, which he was doing this week. Yeah. And it's very hard to sort of say, and we played a clip from Rona McDaniel this week, who's Mitt Romney's
niece and the head of the RNC.
Head of the RNC and a huge Trumpist. She went to Georgia because they're worried about Georgia. And she was trying to rally the troops, and the troops were all yelling like, it's fixed. We don't, yeah. You know, what's the point? And she's having to go, no, you should vote. Even though, I mean, this is the thing. Brian Kemp and Raffensperger and Hugo Chavez and George Soros, and they're all involved. And Tupac, they're all involved in this conspiracy to throw the vote. But you should just go out and vote anyways. Right? Like, I mean, you can't
hard to thread that
needle. It's hard to thread that needle. And I can't help but think that Bill Barr is doing this now as a way of basically saying, like,
Turn the page. Get out the vote.
Right.
Turn the Carter page.
I mean, I think he's basically saying to Trump, like, look, enough.
Yeah.
And we've extracted everything that we need from you. You are done now. And I wonder if I'm Donald Trump, if I'm not taking Barr's insubordination, right, as like a veiled threat. Like, you know, I'm Bill Barr. I'm just sitting here. I got the Southern District of New York. You got rulings coming. He wants to pardon himself. Pardon Michael Flynn. Talking about pardoning Rudy Giuliani, which is interesting because I don't know what pardoned Giuliani for, unless Giuliani thought there was some problems that he had, maybe.
Maybe involving the Borat film.
Who knows? At the very least. But Bill Barr could be sitting there going like, well, you know, I don't know if the DOJ is going to accept you to pardon yourself. I mean, who knows? I wouldn't put it past him. So. It's a very interesting time. I mean, it's still equally crazy in some respects.
Right.
But I can't lie that, like, I feel, I don't want to say hopeful because the country's on fire with COVID, and that's only going to get worse for at least, I think, another 6 weeks. I think it's going to take until mid-January until people, like, it's bad enough where you have some of these states where they just go, like, it's cold out anyways. I'll wear a scarf around my face. But there is a sense of, like, just I have a little bit less anxiety.
Yeah.
I'm awake only for like an hour and a half in the middle of the night now, not 2.5 hours.
It's good to hear.
Yeah, that's good, right? I mean, yeah. Do you feel that?
I do. I mean, I guess I feel some semblance of relief that there will be a president that does take COVID seriously,
right?
That will re-enter into the Iran deal, hopefully, if Israel hasn't completely sabotaged that with the help of Trump, that we will re-enter the Paris Climate Accord, that maybe we will end the genocide in Yemen, just things that I care about that the Biden administration, the latter maybe not so, but will do automatically. But I know he signaled support.
All those things, I think those are very reasonable expectations, yes, for what's going to happen from this administration. Once you get past that, things get a little bit murky.
Right.
But I do like the idea that I feel like, you know, we're not pushing against the string here. We're pushing against, you know, there's a force and we can, you know, it's conceivable. I, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but it's conceivable that we will push on certain areas. And really, in many respects, we're just setting up for future battles. I mean, Georgia's so huge in terms of like what can be expected.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's a lot of reasons to want the Democrats to win in Georgia, but you know, a big one from a progressive perspective, from a left perspective, is you don't want the Democrats to have an easy out as to why they are not making certain changes. Now, to prepare people for this right now, they're going to pretend like reconciliation doesn't exist if they get these two wins in Georgia. They're going to pretend like the president has no powers. If they
Sleepy
get these
Joe.
Wins in these, he's Sleepy Joe. It's not, you know, Green Lanternism. I just feel like the level of sophistication that people have and the, I mean, I could already feel the difference so dramatically between the run up to Barack Obama's presidency and Joe Biden's.
You know,
it's not just COVID that makes that difference. And so it's going to be an interesting time. And I'm glad that you are on board to help us navigate that.
Same here.
All right. Well, with that said, Emma will be back next week with an interview. Don't know
TBD.
Who. TBD. And we will take a quick break and I'll be back talking to Heather Parton, or you may know her as Digby, and we will talk about another crazy week. Back in a minute. Now here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, it is another one of those weeks. I was just talking to Emma Vigeland, who is joining this program, and saying how every week you and I have come on for what feels like for the past 4 years and have said, boy, this week was crazier than the last one. And it has, in many respects, it is still the case. I mean, it is odd. And I want to maybe touch on that at the end of our talk, just sort of like the difference of knowing that Donald Trump is, his presidency is over to the extent that it's over, versus not. But let's start with, I mean, there are really, I think, two major stories that are happening this week. And then, of course, ancillary stories off of that. One is the just continued exponential rise in infections in this country, in hospitalizations, and in deaths. We crested over 3,000 deaths on a day. I think it was Wednesday of this week. The 7-day average is up around the high 2000s, and hospitalizations are, we crested 100,000 hospitalizations over the week. You were just telling me before we started that California, or at least in LA, you're in lockdown. And there is, I believe in California, Gavin Newsom has said by mid-December, the hospital capacity will be reached. And this is a problem that's going to happen all around the country. It's not just a question of beds, because obviously you can put together, you know, you can put beds in a civic center if you needed to. The problem is there's not enough staff. And so we are on the cusp of not only seeing the typical death rate from the amount of infections we have, which, you know, ranges from like 1.4 to 1.8%. But we may get to that point where we start having deaths as a function of not being able to treat people. And that death rate may go up. I mean, we're going to be looking at perhaps 150 to 200,000 people die in the next couple of months.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we're looking at. And there was an article, I think it was in the New York Times this week, talking about they've now done some analysis of death rates, which they do every year, which also show that we've already had a tremendous number of excess deaths, which they're talking about, you know, deaths that would not have normally happened. even above COVID, which just means that people who had heart attacks, there was probably a lot of this in New York in the spring, where people who otherwise would have been treated, would have gone to the hospital, would have had, you know, gone to the doctor, whatever, that ended up dying, and their deaths were preventable. And the numbers that, I saw in this New York Times article said that, you know, what the real death rate, if you include those excess deaths beyond COVID, is more like 350,000 right now. So you're looking at within the next two or three months, you know, we could be coming up close to that 500,000 mark of excess deaths in this country. And, you know, it's stunning to me that, you know, what we're dealing with here, it just seems as though, I know people are tired of it. I know I am. I'm sick to death of looking at my same four walls in my house, and I'd like to travel and do some other things that I can't do. But on the other hand, you know, we are seeing, you know, this is carnage on a level that I don't think we've ever, you know, this is more than a century ago that we dealt with this, with the 1918 pandemic. And, you know, at that time we didn't have, right, you know, the medical advances that we have now. The idea that we're actually coming with even within striking distance of that level of death, with all the modern advances that we have is just stunning. And part of it is what you just mentioned, is the fact that, you know, we're reaching a point now where this staff, and they're already burnt out, by the way. I mean, we're in 8 months now, and these people have been treating COVID patients, which from everything I read, taking care of these patients is very, very difficult. This is not something where you just come in and, you know, hand them a pill and, you know, give them a shot or something. I mean, this is very labor-intensive work and emotionally draining because the death rate is so high when you're dealing with these people in the ICU. It is, people are not going to be able to take care of us if we go into the hospital for very much longer without breaking. You can't push people on this level. And there's no, what are we going to do? Go train more? And you can't get them anywhere. Right. I mean, at least in New York in the spring, they had this thing, you know, where people were flying in from other parts of the country where it wasn't happening, you know, and they could come in and help. There's no help this time. It's happening everywhere. So, you know, we're in a big problem, and a lot of this, and, you know, I think you and I should probably talk about this a little bit, is the fact that our medical system has been basically, you know, starving itself over many, many years to cut costs, and as a result, in a place like California, well, yeah, I mean, this is 30 million people, however many people here, over 30 million that live here. They've been reducing capacity here for years,
yep,
to save money. And as a result, you know, I mean, I guess we could go build some hospitals quickly. They did it in China. Remember, they built one in 2 weeks there in Wuhan when their pandemic first started. We could do that, but you can't go and train nurses in 2 weeks, and you can't train doctors in 2 weeks. So,
well, people who, I mean, certainly in New York, and this became a big issue, you know, as we nearly overran capacity, and Cuomo had to, I don't know what the word is, essentially, when you do this on a state level, but he had to, like, nationalize the hospital system. Both the private and the public were basically being run out of the governor's office, so that resources, mostly ventilators and staff, were transferred to different parts of the state where they were needed. So if you had extra ones in Rochester, it was sent to Long Island. If you had extra ones in Elmira, they were sent to Albany, whatever it was. But during that time, it was also came out that, and I think that, or I should say, got wider exposure, that Cuomo had cut the public hospital system by 10 to 20% over the course of the past decade. And so there was no extra capacity in the system. And simultaneously, you have, and I think, you know, folks who are nurses or doctors or medical staff who are listening to this, I think they're well aware that you've had this major consolidation in the hospital business, essentially, in the private sector, where hedge funds and or major health companies have bought up hospitals. They get rid of what they consider to be redundancy. They go down. They have been using the numbers that we've always been using so that there is, you know, virtually no waste. And by waste, of course, what we're talking about is extra capacity in the event that you have an event where you need more capacity. And they've also, and we should also say, it's not just a question of like they were trimming fat. In a lot of these places, I mean, I know several folks who are nurses. They talk about just sort of like having to work more and more hours, having to do more and more jobs that used to be done by multiple people. And so we have a situation where not only like supposedly what they considered fat to be extra capacity, but like, you know, a lot of close cutting to the bone, and it leaves you extremely vulnerable to a situation like this. I mean, it's also, frankly, horrible working conditions in a situation not like this, but in a situation like this, it becomes deadly. And it's indicative of the problem that we have in this country with things like consolidation and things like poor resourcing of the public healthcare system. And, you know, I it's not a widely reported story, it seems to me, but it is certainly, you know, in 3 or 4 months, we could be looking back on it and seeing it as one of the most important aspects of this.
Absolutely. And I think, well, and it's starting to become, you know, more, I think it's that the issue is rising to the surface as we're seeing this happening everywhere where, you know, it's from North Dakota, which is one of the hot spots on the planet, to and South Dakota both, to a place like California where you figure that, you know, there are millions and millions of people here. You would assume that they would have plenty of capacity, that this would be a place where you know, we wouldn't face this. Or New York, the same thing. And here we are. So, you know, I honestly think, and I can't remember who said this. There was somebody recently who just sort of made the point that when we get through this, I mean, I know the Biden administration is going to have a lot on his plate, but one of the things that really has to be done, they have got to go back and take a thorough look across the board at what's gone on with this pandemic once they get the vaccination, you know, regime under control and you know, they're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. There has to be some kind, I don't know if it's like a 9/11 commission or what they have to do. But they've got to go back and look because, I mean, the bungling, it of course, you know, the leadership at the top has been miserable and completely, you know, I mean, I think you can lay a lot of this at the feet of the Trump administration, but not everything. There's some systemic problems in this country, and some of it has to do with the fact that we've got all these states operating with different levels of government and different ways of doing things, and that makes it difficult, you know, compared to other countries. But it's more than that. I mean, this goes to the heart of our healthcare system, to our public health system, to, you know, how we deal with national crises in general. And, you know, there's going to have to be a look at this because this isn't going to be the last one. This is just the first one, I think. And yeah, this is going to be happening. This kind of thing is going to be happening more and more. And our preparation was clearly horrible. And then, of course, exacerbated by the fact that we had a buffoon running the country, unfortunately, at the time it happened. But, you know, another problem that needs to be looked into.
Right.
But yeah.
A full accounting of this looks at the at those questions about hospital consolidation.
Absolutely.
Looks at things like our sourcing and our supply lines. And you know, how much technology and how much general products we rely on outside of this country, and mm-hmm. our capacity, and just sort of the reluctance of the Trump administration to use the Defense Authorization Act, and we also, I think, Defense Production Act, and also I think we need more exposure to, you know, sort of, you know, on the flip side, it looks like there's going to be, within 3 or 4 months, Certainly, I think the first batch of vaccines are coming in to New York in within weeks, actually, to do frontline workers and to do folks in nursing homes. Well, the reason why that's happening, and, you know, the story we heard from Pfizer is not part of Operation Warp Speed. But in fact, their partner, Biogen, received $500 million from the German government. And Pfizer itself took $1.5 billion so that all of this production and distribution that is already in the works for a vaccine that has yet to be approved was paid for by the U.S. government. So that in the, you know, on the day that it gets approved, they'll be able to start to provide inoculations. There needs to be more, I think there needs to be an effort by the Biden administration to tout this, because we're living in an age where there is such, I guess, skepticism about the ability of government to do things.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, a big part of that is because so much of what government does is obscured. And that is a, you know, it is, you know, it is, there needs to be propaganda, for lack of a better word, about all the benefits that people receive from government, because it makes it harder for these benefits to reach people when people are so skeptical about it and having an understanding of like exactly what government can and cannot do. There's going to be have to be a lot of reckoning. I'm not convinced that that will happen. But in the meantime, you know, I know that we're going to come back next week and we're going to be talking about more horrible numbers. And so particularly, you know, we're starting, you know, we are now a week out from Thanksgiving. By next week, we're going to see the infection rate, I think, jump significantly. Yep. We're already seeing it, you know, in some places in the data. You can already start to see hints at this. But I think that we are just about in the next couple of days going to see big bumps from Thanksgiving. And then 2 weeks out, 16 to 21 days out, we'll see those bumps in deaths. And that's going to leave us right at just about a Christmas. And who knows what people will be doing during Christmas. I suspect, I hope that people will have, you know, I guess, internalized the problems that this type of travel creates. But we will see. But let's move on to the other story that's happening. You know, Joe Biden is continues to fill his cabinet. We'll have more on that next week. I think that's when we're going to, you know, get the next big round of appointments. But Donald Trump, meanwhile, is, you know, I want to say he's unhinged, but like, he, you know, like he's already unhinged, right? Like, I mean, I don't like the door has been unhinged and now it's been thrown out the window. I don't know how to really wear
it. It's blown off. Yes,
exactly.
Completely. Disintegrated. And there is no door.
And what's most interesting about this, it seems to me, is in addition to the fact that, you know, once again, there has been a real failure by the Democratic leadership to hold the Republican Party to account for enabling all of this, even to the extent that like we see these people, like, you know, there's been an off ramp now. Bill Barr is sort of dropped out of the whole thing. He's given up the ghost. You know, he gave it his the college try. He's been working on and keeping Donald Trump in power for 2 years, and he realizes it's time to cut bait. Mike Pence, story about him sort of like slowly skulking off, walking backwards away from Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
But the really the interesting thing is that there's a runoff in a month. In Georgia, the polling came out this week. Ossoff and Perdue more or less, you know, all but tied in numbers in terms of like the margin of error. Ossoff has a little bit of a lead, but it's, you know, that's that could be just a blip in the numbers. Warnock has a little bit more of a lead, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, also more or less tied. And you've got like some segment of the Republican Party who are basically saying, you don't vote for anybody because it's all rigged And Donald Trump is heading down to Georgia this weekend. And I have no idea what he's going to do. Do you?
No, but I know that the Republicans are terrified that what he's going to do is stand up and talk about how the vote was rigged and the governor is a sellout and the Secretary of State is an enemy of the people, which he already called him once, and that they're all you know, paid off by the voting machine people. I mean, this is all part of what he's been saying. And he just said it this past week. He did a Facebook video. He did a video which he put out on Facebook, and then of course it made the rounds. It wasn't for television, in which he laid out his full case that the election was stolen from him by the millions, and one of the places where it was stolen, in his view, is Georgia. And he's got this whole group of people. I mean, they've got Rudy Giuliani in up in Michigan this week, you know, at a hearing in the middle of the night about the voting and the vote fraud or whatever that was bizarre. But down in Georgia, they have this, you know, this pair of Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood, the local, he's a local defense lawyer who has taken over this part of the case, and they're holding rallies.
We should say he's also the one who's representing that shooter from Wisconsin.
Kyle Rittenhouse,
yes.
Right. And ended up getting him out of jail so that he's out on bail now, Rittenhouse. And Lynn Wood, I mean, both of these people, Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood, are, I mean, talk about unhinged. I mean, they yep. think Donald Trump look, you know, pretty stable by comparison. And they're out there literally just telling people, do not vote for Perdue or Loeffler because they're refusing to call for the vote to be discarded and a revote to be done. I mean, this is what their demand is now. And, you know, they're also backing this thing, as is Michael Flynn, the former, you know, national security advisor for Trump, who he just pardoned, backing calls for martial law and for the military to conduct martial law and, you know, throw out the election and for the military to conduct a new election. I mean, I grant you, these are fringe people. But there are people that Donald Trump is actually, you know, retweeting, and there's a lot of, you know, I mean, these are people that are fairly close to.
Right. I mean, it's hard to sort of like it's fringe, you know, we need to be more specific. Right. Yeah. I think these people are on the fringe of sanity without a doubt. But I mean, it's not clear to me how far on the fringe they are. Of, let's say, the Republican base. I mean, that is what is not clear to me. I mean, because look, Donald Trump has raised, at least $170 million. And that was just from the last reporting. I mean, it could be $180 million. That's an enormous amount of money to have raised in 1 month. And it's coming from somewhere. And
yeah.
You know, 75% of that is going into his super PAC. There's apparently like a little bit of a fine print on this. And 25% is supposedly going into the election protection. And then, of course, there's tons of money going in. Like Sidney Powell was out there saying yesterday, or I should say Wednesday in Atlanta, that she hasn't even touched the money that has come into their fundraising thing because they haven't had time to set up, a bank account and whatnot. And I guess they're going to pay themselves in retrospect. But it's unclear to me just sort of like how fringe this is. And I mean, do you have
We know from the polling that Republicans, it's like 75 to 80% of them believe the election was stolen. Now, how many of them are following Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump, for that matter, on their actual, you know, the crazy lawsuits that they're filing and having thrown out of court and the rallies and Donald Trump's Twitter feed and all the rest of this. Whether they're following the details, I don't know, but I think it's a fair number, Sam.
Right.
I think that we're talking about millions of people here. It's not just a few, you know, I mean, look at QAnon. I mean, that's a conspiracy theory that suddenly, you know, I mean, by the time the election came along, they were looking at that. And tens of millions of people had bought into that. So you can imagine how many people are buying into this idea that the election was stolen. whether it's in the abstract or whether or not it's specific to what these people are saying, which is, you know, I mean, talk about unhinged. I mean, the theory that Donald Trump is putting out there is a conspiracy so broad that it includes people throughout the United States, Republican elected officials, vote counters all over the place, and voters in places like, you know, they're African American, you know, voters in places like Detroit and Milwaukee and Philadelphia. I mean, this conspiracy would have to be so huge that, I mean, and nobody's, you know, copped to it yet. Interestingly, you know, kind of unusually, nobody's actually stepped up and said, yeah, I was part of the vast conspiracy that denied Donald Trump the vote. But I think there are a lot of people who are buying into it. And when you look at what's happening in Georgia, I mean, the stakes are very, very high, as we know. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, when we talk about Mitch McConnell and what's going on with the stimulus. The stakes here are very, very high, and the Republicans are freaking out about it. Newt Gingrich, people like him, they're all screaming. Breitbart did a big thing this week about how Lynn Wood was crazy and Sidney Powell was nuts, and then the other part, the Jim Hoft and the Gateway Pundit
right.
type, they're fighting with Breitbart now. You know, I mean, it's freaking them out because this thing may have just hurtled out of control. It may be that, you know, I mean, I know that Mitch and John Thune and, you know, John Cornyn and Lindsey Graham all thought that they had a handle on Donald Trump and they could use him for their own purposes. Well, this thing may have just run right out of their control now.
Basically, this weekend, it's going to be on Saturday, more or less tomorrow, depending on when people hear this. Donald Trump is going to speak in Georgia, and what he says is going to be hugely consequential. I mean, we should talk about this in the context. Like, I mean, if the Democrats take, I mean, let's put it this way. It's possible to overstate what Democrats are going to be able to do,
right,
even if they win both of these things. But if the Democrats take both of these races, I don't think progressives should have really much hope that there's going to be, you know, major progressive legislation. I just don't think that's going to happen with a 50-50 split and, you know, with Joe Manchin as the tie-breaking vote. But what will happen is there will be a massive omnibus bill where every possible spending issue of spending will go into a big reconciliation bill. And there will be an opportunity to get, you know, genuine stimulus to deal with the implications of COVID on our economy and on people's lives. I mean, on December 26th, you're going to have 12 million people who are going to lose their unemployment insurance. Within days after that, you're going to see millions of people subject to eviction across the country. We're seeing people lose their health care. We are seeing people continue to lose their jobs. And the economy is going to get worse. Let's be clear here. Like, you're in lockdown. In New York, we don't have that yet. We may not. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not going to a restaurant, folks. I'm not going to a bar. And I am, you know, we are not going to the supermarket as much. I'm not going into stores. And that's happening around the country. People are just simply going to react to the idea of, like, wait a second, there's no room in the hospitals. The stakes of catching COVID become so much greater than even they were before. And so that is going to severely curtail economic activity. And, you know, rightfully so, of course. I mean, who can be blamed? But, you know, last time this happened, there was a $1,200 stimulus check that was sent to everybody making less than $70,000. There was $2,400 a month extra that unemployed people had. You had moratoriums on evictions. I mean, none of that exists now. And none of it's going to exist in January. And we're going to be probably in a worse situation. I mean, this is it is hard to overstate how bad this is going to get. And, you know, Mitch McConnell must be aware of this, if you and I could talk about it. And he's not budging off of $500 billion, none of which is going from like states and cities. None of it is going to testing. Yep. It's all going into the PPP, more or less, for this guy. And frankly, the PPP is it's done. I mean, there's no there was still money left in it because those businesses that needed the money, they took it already. And the people who didn't need it, you know, or needed it, went out of business. And so the. You know, and right now you got Pelosi and Schumer trying to get $900 billion or so with like a gang of four. But Mitch McConnell won't bring it up in the Senate. That's I mean, he has that ability. And the idea of the Democrats winning both of those is dramatic in terms of, you know, for the sake of the country. I mean, put aside like, you know, what I would want from a progressive wish list of things like we need some basic stuff that, you know, the Republicans and Democrats were able to provide in March when the, you know, Donald Trump was like, this could help me get reelected. And maybe it did help at least his election chances. But
I bet it helped the Republicans. I bet it helped them. I mean, they seem to, you know, they got credit in some ways, I think, from a lot of sort of working people who benefited from some of that stuff.
Yep.
And won re-election. I mean, you know, I mean, this is, I mean, what I'm watching with Mitch McConnell, I mean, you know, has there ever been a person as evil as him in a position of power like this in America? Because I don't think there has been. I mean, he is up there with the worst villains we have ever had.
It is psychotic.
He's sitting there. It is psychotic. It is twisted. I mean, here we are. I mean, they are talking about a surge upon a surge. You know, 500,000 people potentially dead. You know, yes, we've got a vaccine coming, but everybody knows that the vaccine is not going to be able to inoculate the entire country for months. And meanwhile, we're in this, the worst wave of the pandemic is happening. And he's sitting there playing these games. I mean, the speeches he's been giving this week on the floor, if people who are listening here have not seen them, go find them. They're on YouTube and various places. I mean, this is a sick human being. I mean, he is sitting there playing these games, refusing, and yet very sanctimoniously saying, oh, we're going to get something done. We're going to do something for the people. And all the while, refusing to even consider something, you know, like they came up with one of these stimulus. Well, it'll be less than $1 trillion. Will that make you happy? Similar to what happened
right.
in 2009. And, it, you know, you had Chris Coons and you had the moderates and all these people there kind of, you know, working together. And no, he absolutely said, no, we're not doing that. And basically is refusing. I mean, he's not even letting Republicans come on the floor with any amendments, do anything. I mean, he is just basically shutting it down and saying my way or the highway and refusing to do another $1,200 you know, lump payment, which would be very helpful, and refusing to do anything, you know, close to what they did with the unemployment. And, you know, I mean, just absolutely, he's holding out for this liability for corporations, you know, again. This whole thing is just, I mean, it's a nightmare to have someone like this in charge in a crisis. I mean, I don't know. It couldn't be any worse. And this is not Donald Trump, people. This is not. This is Trump is off, you know, talking about, you know, Hugo Chavez and
right.
and voting machines. He's not even involved in this.
Right.
I mean, this is not him.
Right.
This is the Republican Party led by Mitch McConnell. And, you know, we can. And you know, you're right about the fact, you know, I don't think progressives are going to be particularly happy even with the two that if we win them. This is going to be a pitched battle no matter what, because there's a bunch of there are some centrist leaners who are going to cause a lot of trouble, as they usually do. But this is what this is about right now. This is about saving people's lives, businesses, keeping, I mean, the amount of evictions alone that are going to happen here at the first of the year, in the middle of the pandemic, by the way, in the middle of the crisis, the horrible surge where people are dying, and people are going to be dying in the streets. I mean, this is ridiculous. And they're not, and you know, Mitch doesn't have any desire to do anything about any of that stuff. So, I mean, this is an evil human being, and I'm not sure what he thinks he's going to get out of this, but I, you know, I'm to the point where I think it's just, you know, he just wants to do it because he can, and there's no other benefit to him.
And we are and to some extent, we are seeing the Democrats reaping what they sowed in terms yep. of not communicating to the American public that the problem is not just Trump, that yep. that the Republican Party has been enabling Trump and has been on its own, distinct from Trump, or, you know, as a unit, been engaging in this type of stuff. And the failure to do that is now coming back to haunt them, where, you know, people are just sitting around going like, Washington's broken. And, you know, all the, like you say, the Gang of Four and moderate and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. Even their this is their go-to playbook, right? Where the Gang of Four comes in and marches in, and you know this is the moderates, so-called moderates, carry the day. When in fact, in many respects, it's just sort of like a cover for a lot of the corporatists in both parties to sort of shovel money in one direction, a little bit out the other side, but make sure that that is, you know, that spigot is controlled in the way that they want to control it. But even that is not even working. And it is, it's stunning. I mean, it really is stunning. And, you know, I don't know what happens, you know, from here. I mean, it really is, it's incredibly disturbing. But that is where we are. And, it makes those Senate seats so, crucial at the very least, if only because there will be one big, like I say, one big stimulus bill. It may be one of the few opportunities the Democrats have to pass anything. But the desperation that, this country is going to feel by the time we're talking about the end of January. I mean, it's 2 months away. And if you look at just like what has happened in the past couple of weeks, it's just mind boggling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And the fact that we're, you know, you've got this craziness that's happening, you know, on the right with these people, you know, arguing over the election results. The Republicans, again, another example of them failing. You know, Bill Barr gets big kudos this week because he stepped up and said, well, we found no evidence of systemic voter fraud that would change the election. You know, it's, oh, my God, that, you know, Trump wants to fire him. And they've got, you know, all these, the right-wingers are, you know, out for blood. And you know, this is craziness. We're in the midst of a horrible, horrible crisis. And, you know, we've got this lunacy happening about the election, which was clear. I mean, at this point, Joe Biden won by 7 million votes. It's a large spread, 4.5 yep. percentage points. It's one of, you know, I mean, I guess I can't remember what it was. Somebody said it was the 10th biggest spread in American history. So, you know, it's a decisive victory. And the fact that we're still arguing about this, and by the way, the Republicans still aren't stepping up and saying, look, time to, you know, come on, let's put an end to this. They're not saying it. They won't do it. And there was an article this week in one of those Never Trump publications with an interview with Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin. And he's one of Trump's, you know, most vociferous defenders. He really, really, and he's way out there too. I mean, he's talking about all the conspiracies, and he's, you know, he's one of the crazies in the Senate. And he had been on a phone call with somebody apparently 2 weeks ago, in which he said, "Oh yeah, I know Biden won, but you know, we got to do this because you know we need you know to remain in power. We've got to you know." He was very, very practical about all this. That this is really about maintaining their leverage, maintaining yep. their you know, the benefits of having this crazy base. And you know, this isn't, you know, this is cynicism. It isn't craziness on the part of the elected Republican officials. They know what they're dealing with. They know what's going on. They benefit from it, and
absolutely.
So they are continuing it.
Absolutely. And I also, it drives me crazy to see this as characterized as cowardice.
No,
because,
it isn't.
Because it is not cowardice. It is exactly what you say. It is they have an agenda. They are fulfilling it. To say that it's cowardice implies that they have some other agenda that they want to fulfill, that they have the best interest in the country at mind, and they just don't have the courage. They don't have the courage to fight back because they can't take the punishment that they'll get. No, on the contrary, these are people who are aspiring for more power, and this is the mechanism in which they are aspiring for that power. And it drives me crazy when I hear people talk about they're cowards. They are not cowards. They are being very bold, and they are going out and they are doing exactly what they want to do. They are taking advantage. They are opportunists. They see an opportunity. They do not care at all about the implications of it. They are just going for it. And it's really important for people to understand that, because when you look at it as cowardice, they are almost like there's almost this quality like they're victimized by their own, electorate, and they're not victimized. They are enabled by their own electorate. They enable that electorate. They create it. They have agency, and they are using it. And, we've talked on the show, where we hear Democratic politicians say, in secret, they admit this to me. And it's like, why you're perpetuating this sort of notion.
Why are you helping them?
You're helping them, and you are being used by them. That is not. They're not secretly admitting to you that they're cowardly. What they're doing is they're exploiting your inability to see what they're doing.
Right, your gullibility, that they know that you're a mark, and they're doing it to you too, just like they are to their own voters, to everybody else.
Yep.
Look at Mitch McConnell again. He's the avatar of this. The cynicism in that man is beyond, there are no limits to his cynicism. And and by the way, I just want to bring up one new aspect of this that I think is important. I wrote about it for Salon this week. Is that we're seeing this return of this smarmy, sanctimonious adult in the room pretense that they like to put on, as if Donald Trump never happened. So now Democrats are sitting there, having to fight this ridiculous people like John Cornyn and Nikki Haley coming out and saying, we really don't care for some of Joe Biden's cabinet picks because they've treated Republicans so poorly. I'm talking about Neera Tanden.
Mm-hmm.
She's treated people, Republicans so poorly on Twitter. Now, I'm not saying anything about Neera Tanden. She's not my favorite person, and I think she did act like an idiot on Twitter. So, I'm not going to defend her.
Right.
But that's not Republican business. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's not about it. They have no standing here. Shut the hell up.
I agree.
This is, if Democrats, we can fight about that, and we have a right to, and we will. But this is not about them. But they're using this stuff. Now, acting, this way without even, John Cornyn got on the floor and said, I really think we need transparency with anybody who has any dealings with foreign governments. Are you kidding me? This is a guy who voted for Commerce Secretary. Wilbur Ross, who just last month was revealed to have been on the board of a Chinese company while he was running the trade war. This is ridiculous. But they're going to do this thing, and the Republicans and the Democrats are going to fall for it again. They're going to sit there and go, "Oh no, we're not hypocrites. Sure, we're going to do this, that, and the other." And that's our job, is to, as Democrats or people on the left or however you want to define yourself, as we keep our own house clean, okay? This is not, has nothing to do with Republicans. They have nothing to say about this. Democrats will need to enforce their own ethics rules, do all of that. I have nothing, of course they need to. But Republicans need to shut up about it. And what they're going to do is use that as a way to sort of present themselves as somehow, the irony is enough to make your head explode, as being somehow above, Democratic ethics. And it's insane. The hypocrisy isn't even, as I wrote in my piece, I said, it's not hypocrisy, it's shamelessness on a level that's downright psychopathic.
Right.
This is at a point where they're just trying to drive us crazy.
And I can guarantee you the media is going to echo these concerns.
Yeah.
Because
that
is the way that the structure works. And that's what Democrats, you know, and it's hard to watch them, you know, sort of make this mistake over and over again. Hard to watch them make this mistake and not think that at least some of it is purposeful in some circles, right? You cannot, I mean, you know, we've said this, the Republicans making these outlandish, you know, sort of like pretense, you know, maintaining this pretense and the press following, you know, and echoing it, right, is the flip side of Democrats not calling out the Republicans and expecting the press to do it for them. No, you know, like the press is just going to follow what the parties do. If you're the opposition party, the press is going to function like we're not going to get out ahead of the opposition party. That's not what they do. I mean, I'm talking broadly speaking. You know, you'll have outlets, some outlets that will. But for the most part, like the conventional wisdom is like, we can't go further than the Democrats in criticizing the Republicans or reporting on the Republicans, right? Because they're the opposition party. If they're not saying it, you know, why would we? And they will then dutifully do the same when the Republicans do it, except the Republicans take advantage of that. Democrats don't. And, you know, when you see stuff like, and maybe it's because I see this stuff up close with like Andrew Cuomo midwifing the IDC, which was a caucus full, a handful of Democrats who caucused with the Republicans as a way of Andrew Cuomo not having to get too progressive of legislation to his desk. He midwifed that whole thing. And then that got destroyed when he was challenged by Cynthia Nixon and Zephyr Teachout over the course of two cycles. Or when you see Andrew Cuomo try and, you know, help the Republicans prevent the Democrats in the legislature to get a supermajority so that he doesn't have to veto bills because he wants to project this sort of like, or he wants, or he just simply is, has interests that are to the right of the right. Democratic Party. I mean, you know, when you see this stuff in the national Democratic leadership where they do not confront certain things or they, you know, it really makes you wonder if what we're watching is incompetence or if it's competent, but just with a very different agenda. Right. And so that is stuff for people to keep an eye on. We will be back next week, Heather, and with probably not necessarily more good news, probably with more bad news, but important to discuss and learn from it. And so that when the opportunity to for good stuff to happen, that folks are aware of it. But Heather, stay safe. As always, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Head over to rofpodcast.com. Do us both a favor. Support the show by becoming a member. Also, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream every day at noon or later as a podcast. Also, you want headline news? AM Quickie every morning. Look for it on your podcast server, AM Quickie. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire. But if I-